hoping to finish chapters 11 and 12, finish the whole book out tonight. As you look at the page, you'll see that 11 and 12 are really very small chapters, very short chapters. However, this is going to be a really schizophrenic kind of a class tonight, because now I'm going to spend about a third of the time, I guess, on something that's absolutely, totally, and completely unrelated to Ecclesiastes at all. But I've been agonizing now, I think, for probably 4 or 5 weeks on the confluence of circumstances here regarding the Sunday morning sermon material, which is coming to a close as we've been studying for a year now the life of Christ. And then the Sunday evening time slot, where we just finished with the Song of Solomon, and here tonight is our conclusion in Ecclesiastes, the last of the three books that Solomon wrote. So we'll be done with that collection of biblical literature. And then, that's Wednesday night as well, because we're finishing Ecclesiastes. We just finished Song of Solomon. So I've got all three of these, the Sunday morning sermon, the Sunday evening sermon, and the Wednesday class, that came to an end at exactly the same time, so really close to each other. I hate it when that happens. I don't do it on purpose, but apparently I can't stop it either. So all three came together at the same time. So I've been wrestling and wrestling and wrestling with, you know, what materials to be teaching. And I have an idea tonight about a class that I've taught now three times before. Was so popular in one congregation that after the first time I taught it, we had about 5 or 6 years, and then they wanted to do it again. And it is, though, a very involved class, and I've mentioned it a time or two to the elders, and I thought tonight I would give you kind of a more full overview of what this class would be, which I think would fit best into this time slot on Wednesday nights. And then, with this presentation, 10, 15 minutes, the elders will know more about it so they can be involved in that decision. You'll know more about it so that you can weigh in on whether or not you'd like to embark on this. Because it would be at least a year and a half investment in this particular class. Now, what it is that I have done is a class on the entire Bible in chronological or consecutive order. This book is the chronological study Bible. That's the paper cover that it comes in. Now, with all my books, as soon as I buy a book, I throw that cover away. And this is what it looks like when you strip that off. And so this is my copy right here. And what this is, Lagarde Smith did this with the Narrated Bible in the New International Version. This is a different group that has done it in the New King James Version, which is a translation I like a good deal better than the New International. I think it's a much better translation. But all they're doing is taking the flow of world history and placing all of the Bible books in proper order. As you all well know, the Bible is a library of 66 books. But those books have not been collected into the covers as we know the Bible today in chronological order. And quite a few of these books span vast reaches of time so that other books fit into, you know, various places in the larger book. And it can be very, very confusing. And so a chronological arrangement of the Bible is designed to give us points of contact and establish a structure, a framework, so that we can understand the Bible more clearly, see how all the books relate to each other, see how they relate to world history as well, and hopefully develop, you know, a framework that we can carry with us for years and years, the rest of our lives to come. It's a very helpful way of getting the big picture on all the Bible material. In order to do this, you have to buy a new Bible. That'll be the big problem on this, and I'll spring the cost on you later. But, you know, that's the big problem, is that there is no Bible, you know, that any of you own, likely, that's arranged in chronological order. And for instance, with the book of Acts in the New Testament, the epistles of Paul are written, most of them, during the 30 years that the book of Acts is covering.
the history that is the book of Acts tells us about Paul going from city to city on three different journeys, and we learn that he writes various of the New Testament epistles while he's on those journeys. What this book and the other book, the narrative Bible, do is you start reading, you know, the book of Acts, and then when Paul gets to a city where he writes a book, you've just read about that city and what's going on in that city, then on that same page you start reading that book. You read the book at the time and place where Paul wrote it. When you get done, you go back to the history of the book of Acts, you read how he went on to the next city, and when he wrote the next book, then the book that he wrote at that time, the book of Acts, appears right there. It's the next thing that you read. So it takes a tremendous amount of work to arrange all of the Bible's words and chapters and books into a chronological order like that. Now, I did it twice with the Narrated Bible by F. Legard Smith. You will have heard me recommend this, you know, time and again in the last 3 years. I'm more strongly recommending now the Chronological Study Bible, not only because it has additional information within that Bible more than Legard did with his Narrated Bible. So I'd be recommending this one, the Chronological Study Bible. And I wanted to introduce you to it, you know, here this evening, just so you get a clear picture of what this class would be like. And all this is this photograph of pages 972 and 973. All right, so it's in the book of Esther. And what that is, and we're now going to zoom in, as you look at the large part here, you can see that there's various different colored areas on the page. So on this next slide, we're going to zoom in and look at what's inside that red block right there. And then again, another red block. At the top of every single page, there's going to be a large time reference that gives you the general information that this book fits in. In this case, it's 586 to 332 B.C. Well, that's 250 years. The book of Esther fit in, you know, what took place in that time frame, which is the time frame from the Babylonian captivity to the time of Alexander the Great. So there are various events that took place in Bible history in that larger time frame. One of them is the book of Esther. And then it tells you on that page what verses are being covered on that page. Chapter 2, verse 7 and chapter 2, verse 23 in this case. Now, in the block immediately below that, it says, Mordecai, Esther's famous guardian. And I'm not going to read all of this. I don't think you'd be able to read all of this from where you're seated anyway. But this block just gives you information to help us develop a clearer picture of what's going on. In this case, what it does is it goes to uninspired, that is, extra-biblical writings. They have found two different mentions in a Babylonian tablet and another one, I forget where they found it, somewhere in Mesopotamia, that have the name Mardukah, which was their spelling for Mordecai. And so the Bible doesn't tell us about the name and how it was used, you know, back in those times. It just introduces us to a guy named Mordecai. But what this does is show that there is archaeological evidence at least two times of a man named Mordecai who had influence within the Persian Empire at the time that the events of Esther were taking place. So frequently throughout this Bible, it will pull in, you know, extra-biblical, outside the Bible references that, archaeological evidence that helps us to appreciate that this, you know, took place, and we may even have references to the very man mentioned by the Bible in these Babylonian tablets and Aramaic papyri. So helpful ancillary information. Then, back to the page I showed you a minute ago, see this block down the lower left-hand corner. When you zoom in on that, it is, again, time information, but now much more specifically to the chapter 2, verse 7 through 23 that you're actually studying. So this time capsule is called, there's just hundreds of these, I guess, in the Bible, it's from 486 to 479 B.C. Well, that's a real narrow time frame, it's only 7 years. Xerxes I of Persia is also known as Ahasuerus. Epigrerus. This is the time for you serious historical students that Herodotus, the Greek historian, was writing. Xerxes invaded Greece in 480. He was defeated by the Athenians also later that year. 479, he suffered his final defeat in a place called Plataea. This is not information you'll ever see in your Bible, but it's helpful for Bible students to see that these events were taking place around and within the time that the book of Esther was taking place. Now, this is an example of Esther throughout the Bible. They have a marvelous one that, you know, has to do with referencing events in Jesus' life. These time capsules are just tremendously helpful, in my opinion. So there's so much information about time references that they take other forms in this Bible as well. This, for instance, is a chart that they've developed to help us understand the period of time of the, quote, divided kingdom. With Solomon's death, we'll be seeing the last of his writings tonight. With Solomon's death, what he feared in Ecclesiastes that we've already read, that everything he had acquired will be given to his son, and who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Well, as it turns out in the biblical history, we are told that his son, Rehoboam, was a fool. And when he became king in 930 BC upon the death of Solomon, his foolishness resulted in civil war in a divided kingdom that would last for centuries to come. It's a terrible thing. But it's also very confusing, because now you're going to be reading both major and minor prophets referencing kings of Israel. And these kings, some of them, will be reigning over the 10 tribes in the north who rebelled under Jeroboam the first and became a separate kingdom up there in the north. And then you're going to be reading about kings in the south over Jerusalem, Judea, Benjamin, down here with Rehoboam being the first of those. And so their charts then will be throughout all those years that will show you above this pink line, these are the northern kingdom kings, tells you who they are when they reign. Down here, the southern kingdom kings, tells you who they are when they reign. It helps you tremendously as you're going through the prophets now. You read some guy's name, you'll be able to look right on the page, find out what the date is. Again, the Bible seldom gives you, you know, dates like that, always only referencing the kings. So it translates it into the terminology we know. Well, it was 910 BC. See? So, and additional information as well. Very common throughout the book. Here's another way they do time. It is hard to figure out when Abraham lived. It's just tough. And so there's two major propositions. They're separated by 100 and some odd years. And so what they do is they give you the biblical references to tell us about dating this man. And then they add it up and divide and multiply, you know, and give you the two general time frames that are most likely the time when Abraham might have lived. Because the Bible does not say he was born, you know, in 1446 BC and he died in 1525, the other way, 13 BC. It doesn't tell you that. So wherever we have occasions that the skeptic attacks the Bible and says, see, you can't believe that. Oh, I know, it doesn't add up. You know, it makes no sense. Well, very advanced scholars then have come together to consider the various possibilities. And they'll give you a chart like this that will help you to understand that the skeptic's grand charge that the Bible is junk, you know, is absolutely false. And then we study in more detail what is the solution to this problem that, you know, we're having trouble with. Okay, then one last time reference. In this case, brethren, the history of Jerusalem, you know, it's fascinating. But we don't get dates the way we keep time in our Bibles about that city. And you're going to read about it for centuries and centuries throughout your Bible. What was going on, you know, at that time? So here, for instance, is a chart called the Fate of Jerusalem. It tells you that 332 B.C., remember when Esther was in the time frame 586 to 332 on top of the page? Well, that's because in 332 everything changed. Palestine was conquered by Alexander the Great. Did you know that? And then later,
down here, for instance, in 63 BC, with 63 BC, that the Roman general Pompey took advantage of a struggle between the Jewish rulers of Palestine, and he captured Jerusalem for Rome. And we all know that Jerusalem and the Jews, Palestine, was under Roman domination at the time of Christ. But who knows any of the history about it? Well, it was Pompey in 63 BC. So when Jesus was born, these Jews had been under Roman domination for 60-some-odd years already. So once again, it's just establishing a framework for us to see there aren't any contradictions in the Bible. There aren't any contradictions with uninspired history or the archaeological record. But there are people who make arguments that there are. And so the scholars then are helping us to see the solutions, to understand what's going on, and hopefully to be able to answer some of the arguments as well when people try to deny biblical veracity. So enough on time frames, but same page that I showed you to begin with now. You're coming over 973 now. Up at the top, there's a block. When you zoom in, it looks like this. Transitions is another category of information that's put into this book frequently, very regularly. Whenever you have a time break between two Bible books or between information that's within it, or you have a new book you're going to start and it wants to transition from what you've been reading to what's contained in this new book, it'll give you some information that helps you to bridge the gap. So the Bible just has two books. It's kind of jarring. You wonder what's going on. This will give you a little bridge and explain, here's what's happening. In this case, it had to do with Esther then. So it's telling us about, his plot to destroy the Jews. It's, for instance, just down here, the Feast of Purim, which commemorates the events of the story of Esther, the Jews still commemorating that feast to this day, takes its name from the Hebrew word pur, P-U-R, which means lost, which was an integral part of the story. But that part isn't explained in the story itself. You don't know the derivation of the words and whatnot. And so it helps make a transition and bridge gap for you there. But these transitions have a wide variety of information in them. For instance, how long was Noah in the ark? Well, 371 days. How do you know that? Well, you read these verses, and then you take a start and a finish over here. Don't forget 8:5, 8:13. When you put that together, then 57 days later, according to 8:14 through 19, this is how we know how long he was in the ark. So what they do is they collect all the biblical information now, put it together in a single slot. Now you know. True to their studies then, very, very helpful. And then, at the bottom right of this particular page, you're going to have your maps not in a collection of just five pages at the end of your Bible. Pick up your Bible map. Go to the back. What kind of maps do you have? Well, this book has hundreds of maps. And those maps are not arranged on a couple of pages at the back. They're inserted on the page in the text. Persia King Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes I, and Esther came together, and it's getting bad here with my voice, but when they did, the Persian Empire embraced this territory, and a little bit of history is given about Cyrus right there. So it's ancillary, extra-biblical information. Pardon me. In Genesis, and we're just changing gears now, chapter 21, verse 33, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree. I'm not pretty sure you can go to heaven without knowing what a tamarisk tree is. Okay? But Bible students want to be as immersed in the text as they can be. We want to understand as fully and as thoroughly as we can. So it's not the least bit necessary, but that's what a tamarisk tree looks like. It just helps you to get into the time, the places, and therefore the people that are being discussed. You read at length in your Bible about this tabernacle in the wilderness. But an artist's rendition of how that thing had been constructed, there on the page, gives you a visual reference to something that was very important visually,
its key components were designed to give the Jews a visual understanding of various aspects of their relationship with God. They got to see it every day during that time frame. Now there on the page of the Bible, you know, you do too, as accurately as we can depict it. Brethren, when you hear about the horns of the altar, what does that mean to you? So man flees to the horns of the altar, and he's clinging to the horns of the altar. You get all these references in the Bible to those things happening with regard to the horns of the altar. But it's not explained to us, okay, in the detail that we would like. It's just the event happened. Well, this is what the horns of an altar look like. How do we know this? Because various altars have been discovered. Those were the horns of the altar and the ones that exist down to this day. So they're portrayed for you here. And you get, again, clearer and clearer picture of what is going on there in Bible times. Now we all know that the turtle doves was, you know, a form of an offering for those who were particularly poor. What does a turtle dove look like? You don't need to know. I know that. But it is nice to know. Those were the birds that they were handling. These were the actual animals that they were presenting before their God. Again, the map thing, this is the map of the first journey, Paul's first journey, are spectacularly well done. You've already been seeing these maps because I went through this book and took my own high-definition photos and made a collection of these maps so that I could present them to you from time to time. So you've already been seeing these maps. They are truly well done. Brethren, I've got a stack of atlases, probably 24 of them. These are some of the best maps you're ever going to find anywhere. So, what it is the book is designed to give you, if you're a more rapid reader, you have more time on your hands, it tells you on every day of the year what you are to be reading so that you'll be able to go through your whole Bible as well as the archaeological information, the geographical information, the chronological information, all that information is on the page, you're just reading straight through. But if you'll take this schedule, you'll get through every word in your entire Bible in 1 year. If you take this schedule, and then that same material they give you 2 days for, it takes 2 years to get through it all. Last time I taught this, I looked at it extensively, and I decided that I was going to do it in a year and a half. So I made up my own schedule. Looks like this. The chart that I created will take us through the whole book in a year and a half. So in a column, it tells you what the week is. It tells you when you're supposed to start reading. It tells you what pages they are. It tells you what the verses are. It tells you how many pages you'll have to read. So you don't get too discouraged. And then a little check mark to show that you got that done. And you're on to the next one. So what I'm saying is, I wanted you to know about it and see how you felt about it and whether or not you want to invest in it, both time, you know, and money-wise. Now, that's the last thing, of course, to talk about. These are $50 books. They're very expensive because they are exceptionally well done. There's a lot of data in there, you know, and so it just is an expensive production. In fact, there's a glossary in the back, a bunch of stuff I didn't even talk about that we can get into later, but I can get these, again, if we buy in bulk, I can get them for $25 a piece. It's still an expensive book, but you really need the book. This is the kind of a class where your regular Bible, if you don't have this book, will be fine, and I'll tell you what verses to read, but if you can't see the map, if you can't see the chronology, you can't see this other information, you're kind of losing the whole point of the class anyway. We're trying to stitch it all together so that in 18 months from now, you will have a very much better picture of what the whole Bible was all about. It is designed to say in 18 months from now, it's like, oh, I got my aerial view of the Bible. Now, usually, in all my other
other classes, you know, we're doing the ground level view. We study verse by verse. We look for what God wants us to understand and to practice in our lives, and that's fine. But this also gives you an overview that I believe is just tremendously important. And you'll be glad you did it. Say, the same church asked me to do it again 5 years later the first time. But it's a $25 investment if we buy, you know, in bulk from a place I found called Discount Bibles or something. But anyway, I have to buy cases at a time. Now, the question for the elders will be how much the elders would be willing to invest. Last time I taught this, we bought about, I think it was 10 copies. That's $250. That we just kept, you know, on a little table at the back. So whenever we did have a visitor on a Wednesday night, we would give them a copy of the book and ask them to leave it when they went home. This one they don't take home. Okay? But we keep a stack. If you forget your Bible, you know, you can have a copy. What I propose is the same thing that I've been doing with Muscle and a Shovel. I'd like to buy enough for the whole class. If you want to do it, and if the elders are agreeable to doing it, neither one of those will nix the whole thing. You know, it's up to the elders ultimately. Now they know as much as you do about it. But we'll talk about it. And then, you know, what I propose is like Muscle and a Shovel. Either I or the church will buy the books, enough for everybody in the class. And hopefully, those of you that can't afford it, please reimburse the church or me personally for your copy. If you cannot afford it, we understand that, we appreciate that, that's great. You know, use one of the, you know, the church's copies then, and when you come to class, you'll always have one, you know, whether you can afford it or not. Hopefully without too high an expenditure for either the church or myself personally, however that goes, you know, we will have copies available for everybody. So, let me just have a show of hands, and for the elders' sake, you know, as well, how many of you think you would like to do that? You want to invest in the copy, get the whole overview, take 18 months and go through it. Okay, so the elders can see it's close to unanimous. All right, so good, great. I really do. I think you'd be very glad you did this. I've always only gotten, you know, really energetic, you know, joyful feedback from it, you know, in the past. So, we'll put it in the elders' court then now, and we'll be talking about that. Thank you very much. Let's now go to the book of Ecclesiastes, these last two tiny little chapters. Oh, I'm sorry, Bill. That's right. You did have your hand up. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Does this book only come in two translations?
I believe so. Bill asked, does the book come in only two translations? The last time I taught it, excuse me, was 2011 and 12. And at that time, I believe there was only one translation, was the New King James. But it seems like now that you say it, that they may have printed since then a second translation. The Narrated Bible by F. Legard Smith is a different book that arranges the Bible in chronological order. That one was in the New International Version only. So when I said two translations, that's what I meant, two different approaches, two different books. Okay? Okay, anybody else? Okay, great. Over to then, Ecclesiastes. Now, what I think is happening here, if you're looking for an outline, and just breaking in at chapter 11, verse 1, where they did a great job with the chapter break right there, and clearly we have a new section here. I can give you this outline. It appears that Solomon now is going to close out the book with chapter 11 and 12, as they've been designated. That gives you three distinct ideas that he develops, you know, obviously several verses apiece. The first of these ideas, you might describe a number of different ways, but I think I'll just use be active. Be involved. After a book that has said a lot of dark things about life under the sun, it is painful, there's injustice, there's all kinds of problems that are going to take place, and when, you know, you work as hard as you can, you may not be able to keep anything you got, you may not be able to enjoy anything you got, you know, it may be a fool that you leave it to, because there's many things that just tell you this is the way the world works, and sometimes it's really not very happy, and things are real wrong. But throughout, I showed you, laced through it, are these places that say, and here's how to be happy while you're going through this, you know, these events. Life ought to be enjoyable nonetheless. Life ought to be satisfying and fulfilling nonetheless. He prepares us for the inevitable problems and disappointments in life, but he's not asking anybody to give up hope or to live miserable, you know, meager existences. He wants people to know the truth about life so they won't be misled and become fools themselves chasing after vanity and futility. He is identifying what really matters. So now that he's come to the end, there are these three final ideas. Get involved, dig in. Don't give up. Don't quit. Don't be a nerd. Be active. Be involved in life. Yes, you're going to have some disappointments, setbacks, and problems, so keep driving on. Number two is be happy. He has been telling us how to be happy throughout. He's going to end up telling us how to be happy one last time. So, here's the way the world is. Get involved. Don't ever give up. Do the best you can with it. And all the while, no matter what happens, be happy, be content, be satisfied, enjoy life. And then there's a third section, which is all of chapter 12, in which he says, and again, you can do this a couple of different ways, but for the two words' sake, you know, be ready. Now, you might have put be righteous, but, you know, be ready. Death is coming, and you know it, but you don't really. Nobody's ever really ready. When Don and I first moved to the Pacific Northwest, I came up in September of 1975. We married in December of 1975. When I moved up to the Pacific Northwest in September of 1975, I moved into the basement of a three-story house that a family was living in that were members of the congregation up there in the Seattle area. Don and I married, brought her out. We lived in that apartment, you know, from our first married days. The man who owned that house at that time died last Sunday night. Family asked me to do the funeral, and I'm both too sick, too far away to do it. I'm not going to be going up there, you know, but he's gone. See, he's been sick for a long time, hospice care. The family knew he was going to die. Were they ready for him to die? No, you're devastated. That also, you know, is a part of life. So, this last section is, let me tell you what your very final days are going to be like. And they are not enjoyable. But be ready, because afterwards, there will be judgment. Now, you and I appreciate, and with that judgment comes either the eternal joy and bliss and satisfaction and fulfillment and contentment of an eternity in heaven, or an alternative that is horrifying to contemplate. So he wants, at the close of this masterful work of wisdom about what it is to live in the flesh, he wants to close with this. Do not be discouraged. Be actively involved in your business. Work, 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 work. Be happy while you do. And remember to be ready, because you cannot avoid death or the judgment which is to follow. The book then ought to be a really very satisfying and encouraging and uplifting book in the end. Here's how it closes. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 6, which have to do with that activity part. Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Sow your seed in the morning,
and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed, or whether both of them alike will be good. Now, especially when we get into chapter 12, there are going to be statements that are very difficult for us to understand 3,000 years away from their culture. We've run into this several times in the book already. Things he says that just completely befuddle us. What in the world, you know, does that mean? Yet always, in the context, it was never a problem whatsoever in understanding what the message was. So we don't know about, you know, the commerce in those days, and we don't know about agriculture in those days, and we don't know a lot of things, you know, about the way they lived their lives in those days. He is referencing, of course, his time, his people, and their ways. They're alien, they're strange to us, and unknown to us, even. This first verse is apparently another one of those. Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you'll find it after many days. Now, Brother, how many of us know who grab a twisted end of Wonder Bread, wing around our heads, throw it out to the sea, and wait for it to come back? Who's going to take, you know, their slight sourdough bread and toss it out, you know, on the water? And who would ever think it would come back again? When you read the commentaries, and I went through quite a few of them, you know, trying to sort this one out, nobody really knows. There's a bunch of propositions. One guy says, well, it's really talking about rice, and another guy says it's talking about corn, and in both cases, though, it has to do with how they planted, and it had to do with floods coming in, and then, kind of like rice paddy, while there was still water out there, they would broadcast, you know, this seed, that would become their slice bread. Okay? And then you'd have other guys and they argue, you know, it can't possibly be. I rather don't think much of that one myself. But, you know, we scratch our heads. We talk about throwing bread on the water. Nobody throws bread on the water. Why would you do such a thing? If you had to pick one, my favorite best guess, which I have about a 10% certainty, you know, is that it ought to fit something that Solomon knew about. And what they did in Egypt along the banks of the Nile with their rice and their corn doesn't help us much. And in Israel, they didn't plant by throwing seeds out on water that way. Yeah, they did in Egypt, but what's that got to do with this? You know, so it's hard to accept those others. But Solomon was a very wealthy importer-exporter. And remember Solomon in Proverbs chapter 31. Everybody come back to Proverbs 31. Now, you all know what that is, especially the women among us, of course, can be familiar with that chapter. And in this description of the worthy woman, this wonderful woman, in Proverbs 31 and verse 14, it says, she is like merchant ships. She brings her what from afar?
Food
in some translations, but guess what? Bread in others. So where's the bread coming back to her from if you translate that word bread? Merchant ships coming over the waters. And so the idea here, perhaps in the vernacular of three millenniums ago, is be involved in your business, one of the chief of which in Israel had to do with them sending those ships out. We have references to Solomon having ships that went out for 3 years at a time, and then Barak, you know, after all their trading, brought, you know, their goods back to Israel for Solomon's sake. Okay? Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, you will find it after many days. I don't know what that means. I think I can understand verse 6. Sow your seed in the morning, don't be idle in the evening. You don't know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed. I get that. Throughout all of these six verses, I get it. Whether he's talking about where a tree falls or when the rain, you know, comes down from a thick cloud, all of it has to do with don't let circumstances, what I'm looking for, paralyze you. Be busy. Whatever the casting the bread is, keep doing it. Whatever the sowing the seed is, keep doing it. Whatever verse 2, the dividing into 7 and 8 is, keep doing it. The idea is, keep doing it.
Aren't you being extremely
one of these worthy women from Proverbs 31, no doubt. Yes, that is another way that this is understood, is that it has to do with charity and always having a willing and open hand to help. And that may be it. See, again, the individual figure is kind of eluding us. But the idea is, if you stay involved, and as Saber well put it, what happens? You get the return, and good will come back to you. Okay?
Please. I have a note here that says it is an investment in time.
Yes. See, and again, this is the great struggle. I say, I read a whole bunch of commentaries. They all had a different idea. And you're all just pointing out a different commentator's idea. That's what it is. But you're all getting to the same point, aren't you? What are the six verses about? Don't be lazy. Don't be static. Don't be inert. Keep busy. Cast your bread. Divide your portion in verse 2. Why? You don't know what misfortune is going to come. Sounds like laying things aside in case of a problem. But it could be an investment. You have somebody else who can help you later. And we have New Testament verses to that effect in 2 Corinthians as well. Then in verse 3, what he's saying is, you're not in control. Do you turn the rain on and off with a spigot? No. If the clouds are full, then what happens? They pour out rain. And if they're not, nothing you can do about it. And when a tree falls down, then what? Then duh. That's where it is. See? But the point is, you're not in control. So, if you thought you were in verse 4, better be careful, because if you're thinking as an actual farmer, and you're just studying all the signs in the skies and everything, you know, and you're going to find that perfect moment, reading that Franklin's almanac, you know, or farmer's, I guess it is, almanac, then what would happen? Well, you'd never plan at all. You're saying, get busy. And then, in 5 and 6, you don't know how it's going to turn out. So quit trying to second guess it. Just be tremendously active. Now then, in verses 7, 8, 9, and 10, you have section number 2. Be happy. The light is pleasant. It's good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all. Let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood. Let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood. Follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. So remove vexation from your heart. Put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. So what did he say?
He said, you parents, get off their case. Why do you think they're all frivolous and foolish, you know, and they need to buckle down and, you know, all of that? See, at the same time, the wise parent needs to know that the kids need this and they deserve this. And they're sure not going to get it later. Okay? Brethren, you know what I formally did this week? I gave up surfing. It is never going to happen again. Now, I grew up in Southern California. I lived on those beaches. My folks used to drop me off at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I wouldn't see them again until dark that night. I was a beach bum for years when I was a kid. Okay? And I loved it. So I decided, you know, I've been living too far away up north. Now, you know, it's only an hour and a half over there. Maybe I'm close enough I can get back to the beach again. So the last couple of weeks, twice, I went over and I rented a board and I got out in the water. You know what I found out? I found out I'm 63 years old and that ain't going to happen again. I got up twice and probably fell on my nose. And the second time I went out, I never did get out. I didn't have the juice for it. I had a wonderful good time. It brought back all kinds of memories. But a surfer I ain't. Okay? Them days is done. Okay? Oh, but I got the memories of it. I spent 5 or 6 years doing that. It was wonderful. When? Back then. Now give it up, because you ain't a kid anymore. using a lot of vernacular here. This is what he's saying. So you parents, and while, you know, if you're wise, while the kids are young,
help them out with it. Let them have it. You kids, go for it. You know, be the best ever, whatever, you know, that the world was. Why you got the time? 10. Remove vexation from your heart. Put away pain from your body. Because childhood, primal life, are fleeting. Now, 12:1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near when you will say, now, brother, I'm nowhere near to this yet, but they're coming for me and they're coming for you. They've come to people you know. They came for Bill Mix in the last few months as he was in that bed and couldn't get out. My friend up north had passed away. Okay? I have no delight in him. My dad had no delight in his last days. When people come to their deathbed, there is no joy in that bed. Long before they get to that deathbed, for an awful lot of people, there is no joy in any moment of their lives. That could come for you. Before, and now apparently, these are figurative expressions about the decay of the human body, quite a few of which none of us really understand anymore, some of which seem to make sense to us, but you have no delight in these days because you're old and feeble is the point of verse 1, and nobody doubts it. So then it says, before the sun, the light, the moon, the stars are darkened. It probably has to do, you know, with either the figurative expression, there's no joy in your life, so it's a dark day, or your eyesight has failed you. Clouds return after the rain. Instead of going away and having sunshiny days, it's just gloom all the time. In the day when the watchmen of the house tremble and mighty men stoop. The grinding ones, which is proposed, are your teeth now, are idle because they're few. Those who look through windows grow dim. The doors on the streets are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. Well, now your ear's failing, maybe. And one will arise at the sound of the bird. Read my dad's journals, 30 years of them, finished about 2 days ago. Pretty heavy-duty reading. Finding out how my dad had come to those days and what he said about those days, and particularly how he wasn't sleeping. And night after night, you know, my dad's journal would be, had a bad night. Okay? Then, into 4, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Once again, maybe you're hearing. 5, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place. Man of terrors on the road. Now, the young are out all hours of the night. Elderly people just don't do that. They know that they can get in big time trouble. They know that they're weak. They know that they're vulnerable. The almond tree blossoms is probably the hair turning white. Grasshopper drags himself along. Well, he used to be also energetic and clicking your heels, you know, everywhere you went. Now you can't hardly get one foot above the other. And then the caperberry is ineffective. Raise your hand if you know what a caperberry is. Because nobody else does, and we'd like to figure it out. Okay. Apparently, maybe a medication of the time, but it isn't working. My dad was the same way. He put down all of his medications. He was telling me about the dosages that he was taking. At the end, he had to do full-on blood transfusions. And the first several of them, you know, after an entire blood transfusion, you know, I mean a replacement, he would feel stronger for a couple of days. But the last one came and didn't help him a bit. And that was what he told my mom. I think I'm done. Okay? Now, okay, you know, the medications don't work anymore. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. So like 11:1 comes 12:1 and following. And I can't tell you what the individual statements are. But I can sure enough figure out that the days will come when you will not have any pleasure in them. And when those days come, it's just before mourners are going about in the street, because you're dead. Remember him. Verse 6. More illustrations. For the silver cord is broken, the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the well is shattered, and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then, whatever that means, the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs, which we studied just before this book. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep His commandments, because this wide variety of translations, the whole of man, applies to man, applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Bill Mitch died apparently just before midnight on Sunday night. He never saw Monday. Bill Mitch has gone to a judgment. He passed through a lifetime of faithful service to his God. He came to the days in which he found no pleasure. And then he went to the Creator. His spirit returned from whence it came. God will, according to verse 14, bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether good or evil. There will be no secrets on that day. So brethren, what is the message of the book of Ecclesiastes? The message is this. Life is a gift from God. Life is sometimes unavoidably, and what is often worse, inexplicably difficult. So, deal with it. And while you're dealing with it, when you're in each stage of life, live that life wisely. When you're young, go enjoy it, because it's great. Grab for all against them. But remember this. You will have to give an answer to your God. So remember Him at every stage of life. And in that manner, you will live a life that is, in my 3-point summary of just the last few chapters, I think now applies to the whole book. You will live an active, energetic, happy and satisfying life that prepares you so that you are ready for your God. Hopefully, you can look back on that life and say, I was full of years, I enjoyed them all, and I'm ready to go home. Dear God, take me now.